NPR's investigation unit has spent a year reporting on sexual assaults against people with intellectual disabilities. The findings are upsetting. Use discretion as we have this difficult conversation here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. NPR found people with intellectual disabilities are sexually assaulted at a rate 7 times higher than those without disabilities. It's a statistic from unpublished federal crime data provided to NPR by the Justice Department. The stories are airing this week and next on Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Here is one of the voices we've been introduced to, a 22-year-old woman who says a former boyfriend hit her and raped her 8 times.
I think people like to take advantage. They like to take advantage with disabilities because I have disabilities, not as bad as theirs, but I think they like to take advantage, which is wrong. I hate that.
That woman says she thinks she was an easy target because she has a mild intellectual disability. Pam Malin is an independent disability consultant who spent more than 30 years in the field. She chairs the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities and is a disability victim advocate for the group Disability Rights Wisconsin. She joins us from the Green Bay area. Pam, welcome to the program. Can you hear us? Hi, Pam.
Yep, I can hear you. Hi.
Hi. Well,
thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Joe Shapiro is the NPR investigative reporter who has been working on these reports across the country. You spoke with him during his year-long investigation. What did you want him to know as he talked with people and told their stories?
Well, Joe and I talked for a number of hours, and what I really thought was important for him to know is that people with developmental disabilities, intellectual disabilities, are abused, sexually abused at an alarming rate. And we don't always have correct consequences or people being held accountable for that. But also we as a society, as families, as caregivers, can do more to help prevent that.
Why are people with disabilities more vulnerable than other people?
The vulnerabilities come from a lot of factors that the people with developmental disabilities can't necessarily control themselves. We have a system that sets them up to be compliant and to agree with or go along with whatever it is that their care, guardian, their family member tells them is best for them. And when we do that, we tend to set them up to just think that the person in authority or in power knows best for them. And those of us who know and work in the sexual assault field know that sexual assault is really not about sex. It's about power and control. So we're setting the individuals up to be in a situation where people always have control or power over their caregiving, over their day, over their meals, over their home, over their choices, and that there sets them up to be vulnerable. And then there's a few other things that are important. People with developmental disabilities aren't always getting good information on healthy relationships. And I always say if somebody doesn't know what a healthy relationship is, then they don't know when they're being taken advantage of, manipulated, or being abused in an unhealthy relationship. So things of that nature really set somebody up to be a victim. And then perpetrators know that individuals with intellectual or developmental disabilities can't always tell what's going on, don't always have a word for what's going on, maybe don't have the ability to communicate what's going on. So there's a number of factors that make it's pretty easy to see why this population is so vulnerable.
In the NPR investigation, they had to ask the Justice Department for this unpublished federal crime data about sexual assaults against people with disabilities. They have the data. It is unpublished. Why is there perhaps this veil of secrecy over this information?
Well, I can't speak to why the information hasn't been published. I'm not sure if there's a timeline or a reason. But I do know that, I mean, just looking at society and what's going on right now with the Me Too movement and Time's Up, I mean, this topic is not something that we as a society talk about very much. And then putting it into a population that we often want to be pushed to the back so that we're not thinking about what kind of cruelties or abuses are happening to people with disabilities. I mean, this is a conversation that should be open to all of us to talk about. And then especially people who are vulnerable, such as people with disabilities.
Pam Malin is with us. She chairs the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. She's also a disability victim advocate for the group Disability Rights Wisconsin. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a disability? Do you carry a greater burden to protect yourself from harm? Is that fair? What is the best way to advocate for people with intellectual disabilities? Do you help care for a family member or a friend who is disabled? How do you look out for their safety? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Pam, caregivers, they help people with intellectual disabilities with incredibly personal tasks, sometimes bathing, sometimes getting dressed. Maybe they're helping multiple people or on a schedule. Do caregivers take people seriously when they say no, and should they?
Well, I mean, I think we should back up a little bit in whether or not people with disabilities are empowered to say no or to have caregivers ask before they touch or ask before they provide care. And that goes back to that compliance conversation that we had as far as people with disabilities who need physical care often are just expected to be ready and accepting of that personal care. And that has to do with their whole body often. And they just have to accept it. And if they don't accept it, or for some reason they say they don't want it, oftentimes that can be taken as somebody who's being manipulative or somebody who's not being compliant. And then there's a whole load of things that could happen as repercussions to that. So we set the person up to just accept the care. And most people, I mean, I really want this to be important for people to hear. Most people who are in the caregiver role of working with people with disabilities, they are there because they love what they do and they want to do better. So I don't want this to sound like all caregivers are bad, but the challenge is that the ones that get in that have a need to take advantage of people, they have somebody who's at their ready and that they can access very easily. And that's really what sets them up. So The counterpoint to that is that we give people with disabilities the voice to say no or to say I don't feel comfortable. And then we teach caregivers and parents and family members to listen to that no and not to just go, oh, well, I know what's better for you. And that tends to be why that becomes such an important issue.
Certainly, parents worry about keeping their kids safe. It could be even harder if a child has an intellectual disability or a developmental disability. What should parents of children with disabilities do to protect their kids?
Well, I think, as I said before, is that teaching them to say no if something doesn't feel comfortable, if they don't want something to happen. Often parents, including myself, when kids are little, we say, go give grandma a hug, go give auntie a hug, things like that. And when the kid kind of says, I don't want to, we kind of push them to do that. And that is the start of the conversation of, if you don't want to, then what else might be okay? And it really isn't about that grandma wants the hug. It's about that child is feeling something internally that says they don't feel comfortable with a hug. And if we start respecting it from little on and tell them that they have the power to say no when somebody says they need to do it anyways, that's the start of the conversation. But, you know, some people will say, well, my son or daughter can't say no, or they don't have that communication to be able to say no. And then I say to the parents, your job is to teach the people around your child, your family members, close friends, respite providers, whoever it is that's in your life, to ask and to watch out for that individual. And if they see either behaviors or things that just don't feel right, that they speak up and say something.
Pam Malin stays with us. She chairs the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. You can join the conversation. Do you have a disability? Do you carry a greater burden to protect yourself from harm? Is that fair? 800-642-1234. What is the best way to advocate for people with disabilities? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after this news update. NPR's investigative unit released a series this week on the hidden epidemic of sexual assault against people with intellectual disabilities. We are talking about it with a Wisconsin-based national expert on sexual violence against people with disabilities here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Before we return to the conversation, let's listen to a moment from a sex education class in Maine to inform and empower people with intellectual disabilities.
So let's try it where I start it and then you guys follow, right? My body is my own.
My body is my own.
And I get to decide what is right for me.
I get to decide what's right for me.
Independent disability consultant Pam Malin stays with us. She's the chair of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work with people who are disabled? Maybe you are a caregiver or in a group home or at a nursing facility. What have people with intellectual disabilities taught you? What should other people know? What is the best way to advocate for people with intellectual disabilities and ensure their safety? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Pam, it's harder for some people with intellectual disabilities to recognize assault or to name abuse. Why is that?
Well, I think it starts with education, both in the home and the schools. We aren't always educating people with disabilities about their body and that it's private and that there are private parts, and that people have to ask permission to touch, and you have to say yes or no. You have the right to say no, and what the reasons those people would be touching for. And again, like I said, people who need personal cares often just accept somebody touching them without any question because that's their daily lives. So it is challenging, but education from little on, I think, is the way to go.
How do you approach that education?
Just like anybody else would approach educating your children without disabilities about their body. I mean, your nose is for smelling, your elbows, you know, are at the middle of your arm, and then your private parts have specific names and specific purposes, and they're not dirty. And oftentimes, I think family members, even with kids without disabilities, struggle on how to talk about those private parts. But then talking about what makes them private. They're private because our underwear cover them, our swimsuits cover them, that we don't go out in public with them exposed. We don't show other people them. Other people can't touch them unless it's for purposes of keeping us clean and healthy. And then as they get older and relationships happen, then you have to expand the conversation. But it's starting from little and then growing the conversation from there.
Let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Liz, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a school counselor in the Madison area, and I also used to work at a library, and I wanted to give a book recommendation to parents, families, anyone that works with children.
Great.
The title of the book is The Exceptional Child's Guide to Touch. And it's a picture book, and what I like about it is it talks about a variety of different types of touch, like accidental touch, friendly touch, harmful touch, even touching myself. And it does so in a way that's really non-judgmental, but it's a great way to have that open conversation with children.
Liz, thank you so much for that contribution. Pam, are books a good vehicle to help explain?
Yeah, I think any resources you can find are great. I mean, there are other books besides the one that Liz mentioned, which is great. There's an author actually who lives in Wisconsin who is a sex educator for people with disabilities. Her name is Terry Cowenhoven. And she has written a number of books that are great for parents about puberty. And there's one that I really like to use a lot with adults with disabilities, which is The Boyfriend-Girlfriend Guide to Dating. And it really has some simplified but good information about respect and what do relationships look like and what do you need to know about somebody when you're dating them. How should they treat you? What do you do if they're not treating you well? Some really good information to have conversations with your son or daughter or with maybe somebody that you're a counselor for, things of that nature.
Let's bring in Kelsey now, who joins us from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi. I was just calling to say that I worked with adults with intellectual disabilities for quite a while, and there's another layer to this that some people with intellectual disabilities have guardians, and so guardians need to give permission for certain agencies or organizations to educate them about appropriate touch, sexual health, boundaries, and some guardians are very reluctant to even open that conversation and identify that their person with an intellectual disability is a sexual person, even though their IQ might be lower.
Mm. Pam, what do you make of that?
Yeah, no, that's very accurate. I think that sometimes guardians want to, especially if they're family guardians, oftentimes they want to think of this individual as their child, and they want to protect their children, even as adults. But guardianship is not the same as being a parent, and guardians don't have the same rights, and they can't tell people that they can't have a relationship unless it's proven that that individual is unsafe in some way. So it's hard, though, because providers are listening to the guardians and also listening to the individuals they provide care for. And oftentimes what the individual wants and what the guardian wants are two different things. And that makes difficult water sometimes to navigate. I truly think that, as I said, education is important for the individuals with disabilities. It's also important for family members or guardians to understand that just like we all want to be in relationships for many reasons, intimacy isn't just sex. Intimacy can also be spending time with somebody you care about, somebody who loves you, somebody you laugh with, somebody you cry with. Individuals with disabilities want the same. And so if we educate parents and guardians, I think that that's a place to start, but we are kind of starting behind the block. And there are a lot of guardians out there that think they're doing what's best, but oftentimes that leads them to be more vulnerable to abuse.
Let's go back to the NPR investigation and meet a woman named Pauline, who is part of NPR's reporting. She met a man at church, and let's take a listen to what Pauline has to say.
What does that mean to have a husband?
He really loves me so much. That's making me feel special.
David makes her feel special. But now, miles apart, she's in Pennsylvania, he's in New York. They talk on the phone most nights. On the dresser in her bedroom, there are pictures of David and the cards he sends, birthday cards, holiday cards, romantic cards. He signs them with his first and last name.
That was Pauline speaking with NPR's Joe Shapiro. Pam, what can you tell us about healthy romantic relationships for people with intellectual disabilities?
Well, I think that story adequately goes back to what I said earlier about people just want to feel needed. and to be accepted in relationships. So I just think it's important for us to remember that people with disabilities are people. And just like all people need to be needed and wanted and want to take care of other people and be around people that they like and make them feel good, that's important for us to embrace and make sure that there is access to other people that they want to meet and opportunities to meet other people and have social and intimate relationships with those individuals. And when we take those away or when we set up situations that are false social situations, what I mean by that is where they're all meeting together, they all have disabilities, but it's only this agency that meets the people together or controls the setting, we're not always giving them opportunity to meet new people and to get access to new relationships. Out in the community is where, you know, I met my husband. Many people meet their relationships. So we really need to make sure that we're giving real, meaningful lives, and within that comes relationships.
We're unpacking a year-long reporting project NPR did to uncover the sexual assault epidemic that is more widespread among people with intellectual disabilities. We're talking about it with Wisconsin disability advocate Pam Malin and getting your thoughts at 800-642-1234. When have you spoken up for someone with an intellectual disability? How can you identify the time to raise concern for another person? Have you seen abuses toward people with intellectual disabilities? What did you do about it? 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Pam, when there is a person who has a history of sexual assault, a person with intellectual disabilities, how does that affect their relationships after the abuse?
Well, I think the key is that if somebody has experienced trauma or abuse, sexual abuse, that they get the right supports when they're ready for them. Usually that's shortly thereafter. And then they get the right education. I mean, I think of many people that I've worked with over the years that when they've been sexually abused and it's been either not believed or not proven or not taken seriously, they then fall into the category, and statistically this shows, that they can be abused again because that's now their idea of love or intimacy or somebody caring for them. And it becomes this cycle of abuse. So the first thing we need to do is make sure that they get support and services, that they're believed. Regardless if we can prove it in a legal system, they have a level of proof that is different than what you and I have the capacity to say, I believe you and that this shouldn't have happened to you. And I will help you to feel safe and what that looks like. So it's important to get stuff up front. But if somebody hasn't gotten that, it's never too late to get them services or supports to help them feel safe and then help them learn what a trusting, respectful, true, intimate relationship looks like.
Let's go to Lisa now, who joins us from Oshkosh. Hi, Lisa. Hi, Lisa. Are you there? Lisa, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi. Oh, we heard you for a second. We're having some difficulty with our phone line. Lisa? Lisa, are you there?
Oh. I am here.
Oh, great. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, good morning. And I guess I wanted to weigh in and just say that I am the parent of a child with severe autism. She is going to be 16. And professionally, I serve as a counselor. When somebody said, remember that these are sexual beings as well, I about fell off my chair because, you know, I'm still reading books at a very primary level to my daughter, who's 16. Cognitively, she can't speak or articulate. and she wears a helmet. She wears diapers, but, you know, she still is, her body is just moving and grooving and changing. And so it's just a really good reminder. And one other thing that I'm learning is, as a mom sometimes, I will admit that I am probably violating her and forcing hugs and kisses and eye contact. Even though I know about the disorder, I'll read books about moms and babies and try to tell her, I'm mom, you're my daughter. You know, like I'm trying to show her positive affection and how to say no and when to, you know, if she says get up and move and push, then I'll leave. But it was just very good reminders today. Also, one thing I was thinking about when somebody made a great reminder that people with disabilities want to be around social environments and seek that out. People with autism, not so much. She tends to go away. She doesn't really view people at so much as social, support, but more like tools to get her things.
Oh.
So I'm trying to just kind of navigate some of those different things, but I'm listening and I appreciate the conversation.
Oh, Lisa, we appreciate your thoughts and reflections. Pam, go ahead.
Lisa, thank you for the reminder. I really want people to know that I'm speaking in general. Certainly, if this isn't one size fits all. But I do think that, as you said, Lisa, oftentimes we get, as parents, we desperately want that connection with our child or that embrace that doesn't come easily for some people with some disabilities. And it's that fine line between you want your child to feel loved and you want to feel loved from your child, and then giving them the tools also, though, to be safe and know when somebody crosses that line or that boundary and it doesn't feel okay. And these are hard waters to navigate, and every person is individual. And probably that in itself lends to one of the reasons why the statistics are so large, is that it's not one size fits all.
You can see a caregiver's quandary, though. They are approaching, books and education at a specific level. But as Lisa said, her daughter, her body is moving and grooving. And so there can be that disconnect there. Can that be difficult, Pam?
Oh, for sure. I mean, the biology doesn't wait for the mind to catch up, and it doesn't always match up, right? I mean, people with intellectual disabilities are at all different levels of understanding and processing, but biology just continues. So, you know, a 16-year-old, like Lisa said, who has a disability that people would say she communicates or she processes at a lower level, her body is still 16, and at 16, we know puberty happens and some of the biological things happen that make her a young woman and eventually a woman. And that's a challenge for parents with kids with disabilities and now adult children with disabilities to navigate those waters. And what are the right decisions to make, and how safe do you make somebody? And, I read there was an article, somebody commented on one of Joe Shapiro's
After listening to the series. I want to put it just a pause there. We're going to get back to that in just a moment. We are talking with Pam Malin and getting your thoughts at 800-642-1234. When have you spoken up for someone with an intellectual disability? What thoughts do you have about safety for people with intellectual disabilities? You can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll return after this news. People with intellectual disabilities are sexually assaulted at 7 times the rate of people who don't have disabilities. We're understanding the magnitude of the problem and looking for solutions on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for staying with us. NPR's investigative unit has spent a year uncovering stories, and we're hearing them this week and next on Morning Edition and All Things Considered reports. Marianne has a disability, a night supervisor at the institution in Washington where she's lived for 4 decades, is on trial for raping her. Marianne can't speak. She knows a few dozen words in sign language. Members of NPR's investigations unit met Marianne and saw her room.
She takes a pillow and rearranges it on her bed. Aww. And now she's making a... Aww. She's making some signs that I don't understand.
Marianne puts both hands just under her eyes and flips them. It's her sign for happy.
That's NPR's Joe Shapiro and his colleagues. They released a series this week examining sexual violence against people with disabilities. Pam Malin stays with us. She's chair of the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities and an independent disability consultant for more than 30 years in the field. Your thoughts are welcome on this topic at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas at WPR.org. Pam, some people with disabilities cannot speak, which means they can't talk about abuse that they have perhaps suffered. What does that change about our role as people in the same community?
Well, I think that then we have to surround people with disabilities with safe people. Their families have to talk to the supports or other family members about just watching out for that individual. If you see something that seems out of place, if you see somebody paying extra attention in ways that kind of make your gut say something's not quite right, if you see behaviors happening where, for example, the individual would go to sleep at night, no problem, with the lights off, and all of a sudden now they need the lights on, and they're fearful of going to bed, or maybe they don't want to go to somebody's house where they always wanted to before. Just watching behaviors and seeing whether or not things have changed. Now, those don't say that abuse is happening, but if you get a few puzzle pieces, often you can put enough together to start looking at whether or not something not quite right in that person's life.
So you can also pick up on some nonverbal cues as well.
Correct. I mean, if somebody is not wanting to go somewhere they've normally gone, or maybe an individual is paying extra attention, or that person with a disability seems to be clingy to one particular staff and really like them more, that doesn't mean that abuse is happening, but it certainly might give you a red flag. And once you start seeing a few of those, it's important for everybody to communicate with each other. If they have a gut feeling, I would say communicate it with a guardian or a caregiver just to say, this just doesn't feel right. Because oftentimes your gut is seeing something that might be happening.
You've now spent decades caring for and advocating for people with disabilities. Have we gotten worse? Are we making any strides, any breakthroughs in understanding this?
Well, I hope to say that we are. I mean, I think with these conversations, with Joe's series that he's put out, with more people being funded to do the work that I'm doing through Disability Rights Wisconsin, and I'm working with victims who've experienced abuse, I hope to say that the statistics are changing. And I do feel like I'm seeing more change, but there isn't always money put into studies to see if the statistics have changed, because this isn't an area that we give a lot of money to or a lot of importance to. And you know, I thank you guys and NPR for actually having this conversation, because that's what we need to do. We need to talk about it, and we need to get the caregivers and the parents and other people in the community aware of it. I think awareness is the first step.
When someone with an intellectual disability has experienced an assault, what is the approach to healing? What is the approach to therapy? Because it probably is quite different than someone who does not have a disability.
Right, right. There are some therapists in the state that work with people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. There are some therapists that are just good therapists and they work with anybody and they do a good job, but it is a challenge. It is different depending on the communication style, depending on the individual. You know, there's all sorts of supports that people can put in place or things that can help the individual feel safer. There's also the ability to call local sexual assault programs and ask what supports they have. Or now at Disability Rights Wisconsin, we have the Victim Advocacy Program. And we work with people who have disabilities who have experienced some sort of abuse or crime against them and can advocate for them in situations. Hopefully we can get this to stop, but there are luckily some good resources that family members or guardians or parents can go to get some help locally. And every community has a sexual assault center or agency, has a domestic violence agency, and then also, like I said, Disability Rights Wisconsin has the Victim Advocacy Program.
It seems like a guardian who may absolutely only want the best and protect that person with an intellectual disability, they still may not always know the right path and perhaps need that advocate or that navigator as they try to understand, first, a violation, and secondly, now where do you go from here?
Yeah, definitely. And that's why the resources are so good to have, is when your family member has been hurt or traumatized, it's hurt or traumatized you as well, because as a parent, as a family member, you want this individual who you love and care for to be safe. And when you find out that somehow they have been a victim of crime or a victim of abuse, you often are reeling from what's going on as well. And you having somebody, a resource to go to help navigate, like you said, the system, whether it's criminal justice system, whether it's finding appropriate therapy, whether it's just talking through your feelings and figuring out what to do next, there's great resources out there.
Pam, let's talk about the labels that we put on people. Are people who've survived sexual abuse or sexual assault, are they victims or are they survivors?
I think that's a personal choice from the person who it's happened to. My philosophy that I have gone with for the years that I've worked, that I don't want to put another label on somebody. I want them to define where they're at. And sometimes people will say, I've been a victim of sexual abuse, and then that's the word I use. Sometimes people will say, I've moved through it, and I now call myself a survivor, and that's what I'll use. I think that us putting labels on people, and in the disability world, this happens an awful lot, us putting labels on people is not okay. It's waiting to find out or asking how somebody wants to be identified. That's really important.
Let's bring in Beth, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Beth. Beth, are you there?
Yeah, go ahead. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks for the program. Really important topic. I've been listening to the national series. One of the things that struck me in the data that Joe Shapiro shared was that a lot of people, that one of the highest categories of perpetrators are actually other people with disabilities, and it made me start thinking about the fact that so many people with intellectual disabilities are in group settings, you know, all day, whether they live in an institution or they're in a group home. And a lot of times people in group homes don't get to choose their roommates. I mean, kind of to Pam's point about not getting to make choices. So, you know, I think a lot of families put, you know, think about group homes and places like that, hoping that it'll be safer, and it maybe isn't. And so I just wondered what guidance Pam might have, you know, around that.
Go ahead, Pam.
Well, the statistic that Joe shares and that is commonly known is that in over 90% of the cases, the perpetrator is known or trusted by the individual who's experienced the abuse. And that's certainly the case with people with disabilities. When it is a peer,
you know, Beth is right in the fact that we have congregate settings. We have group settings where people with disabilities all live together. And we're talking about how the statistic is pretty high that people with disabilities have been sexually assaulted. And then going back to what I said earlier is that if they don't receive the proper supports or education or information, they then oftentimes are subject to being abused again. And then you put them in a setting where they're all living together, maybe not with people that they choose to live with, not with people that they feel safe around. And that's not always the case, but certainly the numbers are higher. Personally, I think that living in the community where you have neighbors and have friends and are with people that you choose to live with makes it safer. If I'm going to a job where I have people who are looking out for my best interest and who are friends with me, they're going to speak up if they see something that they don't necessarily think is right. If I'm going to a setting where it's all people with disabilities and they themselves can't identify abuse, they're not always going to see what's happening to me and or advocate for me to be out of a abusive setting, if that makes sense.
Yes, Pam, thank you so much for joining us. Pam Malin.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, Pam Malin chairs the Wisconsin Board for People with Developmental Disabilities and is a disability victims advocate for the group Disability Rights Wisconsin. The NPR series, it's called Abused and Betrayed. The reports are running on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, and it's the reporting work of Joe Shapiro. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.